biggest threat to voting rights is the perception that the vote is a privilege rather than a right. One thing we know under the law is that voting is considered to be a right. It's a fundamental right. And fundamental rights cannot be, how should we put this? A fundamental right cannot be burdened by the state. Okay, so you cannot create a law that puts a burden on voting. When we passed the 24th Amendment to get rid of poll taxes, it was to take away the burden of taxing the vote. Okay, so you cannot tax the vote. And if you put up especially onerous barriers to registering and qualifying to vote, this can be seen as burdening the vote, especially if you're putting a quantifiable cost on it. So a bunch of documentary requirements that have to be demonstrated to vote.
And it's amazing to me that we go all the way into the 1960s until the Voting Rights Act is passed 50 years ago, and we had to have a law come along to basically, again, get to the point that this is one of the fundamental rights.
Yeah, and you know what happened is all that law did is it put into operational form guarantees that existed in the 14th and the 15th Amendment. And there had been previous successes in voting rights litigation. So, for example, the white primary, which defined access to party primaries in certain southern states based upon race, they get struck down by the Supreme Court as early as the 1930s. And are struck down definitively in 1944. This is based upon laying aside the fiction that the Democratic Party was somehow a private club, when in fact it was the only game in town. It was the only way to effectively get into political power. You had to go through the Democratic Party primary to get a nomination to stand in an unopposed general election to get elected to office. And so the court correctly recognizes that the Democratic Party primary was the election of consequence. So when a seemingly private organization like a party takes on the burden of the state, takes on the role of the state administering elections, it also takes on its obligations. Okay. So when we get to the 1960s, what we're discovering is we're in the midst of what is about a 30-year rearguard action by southern states in particular, but also some other jurisdictions, to resist full and fair access to the ballot. And what we discovered was, as was observed in Mississippi politics in the early 1960s, a legislature can write laws faster than a court can strike them down. So what this meant was the states were not intending to act in good faith. So when the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, it was actually the last in a series of civil rights acts that had been passed in 1957, 1960, and 1964 that had increasingly expanded the role and authority of the national government to bring suit to try and challenge discriminatory practices in the states. Okay, because the Constitution gives the states the right to conduct elections. Okay, that is the purview of the states, subject to certain negative constraints from the national government, what we would call negative rights, that there are places where you cannot prevent someone from voting. You cannot prevent them on the basis of race, creed, color, sex, age, if they're over the age of 18. Okay, so there are certain absolute guarantees where you cannot deny people the vote. Beyond that, the states can set qualifications. So what the law does is it gives to the national government a set of tools that are needed to deal with a very real democratic emergency, which is that individuals on the basis of their race are being denied access to the ballot for no objective reason. It is merely the fact that those individuals in power, those groups in power, want to deny them the vote. So the national government needs this law. The thing we have to remember, though, is that this isn't something that just happened in 65. It had a spark in March of 1965 at the Eben Pettus Bridge, but this was one of a series of televised events that had been moving the civil rights agenda along throughout the 1960s. Much like the events up in Ferguson redefined the debate about race and brought our attention back to policing issues in the United States today, events in Birmingham, Alabama, in Selma, Alabama, events in Mississippi had brought national opinion to bear on this issue, and it simply couldn't be tolerated anymore. The visuals were simply too glaring and too ugly.
Well, it's such a long time ago in many people's minds, and it seems as though the South has come a long way since then. But there are still concerns, and I think there are concerns because of a recent Supreme Court ruling regarding voting rights. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, and actually my next book, Rise and Fall of the Voting Rights Act, with Chuck Bullock and Justin Wirt, directly engages this case. And we didn't anticipate having to write this book. It's my disappointment to have to talk about this, because 10 years ago, when we were debating the extension of the Voting Rights Act, I had made an argument for updating the act, because there were fears that if they didn't update and revise the coverage formula for the act, it could be struck down as unconstitutional. And this is what actually happens in the Shelby County v. Holder case out of Alabama 2 years ago, is the formula for determining whether or not the most aggressive portions of the Voting Rights Act, so-called Section 5 preclearance provision, that formula gets struck down by the Supreme Court in a controversial, divisive decision. But the handwriting had been put on the wall. Congress had been cautioned by expert testimony, bipartisan and nonpartisan expert testimony, that this was a concern. When I testified that we should update the act, the other thing that I observed was the South had been changing, and that there were parts of the South covered by the act that didn't need to be covered anymore. I still believe that. Unfortunately, the thing that myself and a lot of people didn't anticipate was the extent to which we'd see this backlash against Barack Obama, who had not been imagined in 2005 as a political player, this backlash against his presidency among particular conservative elements in the South. The Confederates came out of the attic, and we didn't know that they were floating around this way, and here they are. And the moment the Shelby County decision comes down, all of a sudden we see these voter ID laws getting run. In very select jurisdictions, it's mainly Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas. Actually, mainly Alabama and Texas, and to a certain extent, Arizona. And what it has done is it's brought to the fore the fact that even after a half century of working on progress on race relations and on progress in equal rights and voting, that there was a new generation of conservatives who were prepared to push back. They think voting's a privilege. They do not think that the 14th Amendment's recognition of citizenship should be as expansive as it is. They've not really accepted the reframing of the Constitution that occurred after the Civil War. So 150 years after we fight this war to decide this issue, we're back to having conversations about who's really a citizen.
We're talking with Professor Keith Gaddy. He'll be speaking on voting rights at the Lincoln Legacy Lectures taking place on the UIS campus this week. For years, we have talked about voting rights, and I think it's been framed in the context of African Americans having the right to vote. But most of what we're seeing now is being targeted, I would guess, at Latino voters.
A good chunk, yeah. Well, there are two components to this. Okay, there are issues of citizenship and immigration that get mixed up in this. So we see much of the effort to push back about voter identification requirements being about making sure someone's a citizen. And so that pushback goes mainly against the fastest growing demographic in the U.S. in terms of an electorate, which is Hispanics, and to a lesser extent, Asian Americans. But the big impact is really on African Americans, especially older African Americans in the South, who are less likely to have been born in a hospital, more likely to not have a driver's license, more likely to not have a birth certificate. And litigation that occurred down in Texas, this is where the argument really centered was, if you have ID requirements to vote, how hard is it to get the identification or the documentation to get the identification? And I think the price that was set by one expert down in Texas was that it cost about $72 to pull together all the information that you would need to establish your ID to be able to vote. And further, that if you go to certain parts of Texas, you may have to drive 100 miles to get a driver's license. You take this further, you look at what happened in Alabama last week, where the Alabama legislature defunded and shut down 29 Department of Motor Vehicle license offices, almost entirely in the Black Belt, in counties that are anywhere from 50 to 75% African American. There is this disparate impact that occurs through these decisions that create a vulnerability under the existing voting rights law. But the problem is somebody has to bring the lawsuit, then you have to bring expertise in to testify, and you have to bring lay witnesses in. And it'll take a couple of years to resolve that issue. In the meantime, if you're an African American living in the Black Belt, you got to drive 40 or 50 miles to get a driver's license, which is kind of ironic if you think about it.
So what happens next as far as the way you see things going as far as voting rights in the U.S. and especially when it comes to the Voting Rights Act?
The first part of that question needs to be answered is, what are the problems that we need to address? Because we need a modern voting rights law. We've needed a modern voting rights law for 10 years. And the second part of that question is, what are the prospects for actually achieving that change? We have parts of this country where we have real voter participation issues. If you go to parts of Appalachia, parts of the Midwest, urban centers, Native American reservations, parts of Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma, you have relatively low voter participation, okay? Less than half of eligible people are showing up to vote. That's the same kind of problem we had when the Voting Rights Act was implemented in 1965, is we had low participation in certain communities. We needed to take steps to ensure people had access to the ballot and to get them voting. We have problems with, again, these photo ID laws, whether or not they're being implemented with a discriminatory intent or a discriminatory effect. Are needless burdens being put on the voter in the crafting of these laws? We have a problem with what's called voter caging. Have you ever heard of this practice?
No, I haven't.
Okay, voter caging is a practice that's used to challenge legitimate voters at the polls. What you do is you send a letter via registered mail to a voter, and if they don't respond back to it, that's taken as evidence that they don't reside at that address. So a person comes and tries to vote at the polls. You have somebody standing there who challenges that voter based upon their non-response to that registered letter, because you're arguing that the address they're registered at isn't their legitimate residence, so they shouldn't be allowed to vote. Okay? It's a practice that's mainly been deployed against African-American voters and Democratic voters in predominantly Democratic precincts, mainly in the state of Florida. Okay. But it's also been tried in other parts of the country. That practice has the potential to be racially motivated and also to have a discriminatory impact. Now, the thing about voter caging is it's not an effort by the state to deny anybody the right to vote. It's an exercise by a political party or a political organization to prevent people from voting, and part of what it's meant to do is it's meant to have a chilling effect on the individual when they come to vote. Then we got another problem, which is equal access to functional machinery, okay? When we go into predominantly minority communities, what we're going to do is we're going to find that there are usually fewer voting machines, longer lines, and the voting technology is more likely to break down. Supposedly, the 2002 Help America Vote Act was supposed to deal with this, but now we're finding that technology is 13 years old. Most of that technology was bought, and it's starting to break. Now, you think about it this way. You have a laptop, right?
Right, right.
Okay, how old's your laptop, Sean?
Oh, probably 3 years old.
Okay, would you want to be working on a 13-year-old ThinkPad?
Yeah, right, I understand it.
Yeah, that's the problem, is we're asking voters to vote on outdated technology that has a tremendous likelihood of failing. And we are headed towards another crisis in voting in general regarding our voting technology. It may be that in addition to needing a Voting Rights Act that deals with these new racial issues, these new voting rights issues in Indian country and among Latinos and Asian Americans and in select parts of the Deep South and Texas, we also need an act that deals with the general right of the public to have access to a reliable voting technology that will be fair and implemented in a non-discriminatory fashion. There is one other thing to consider, and I'll probably touch on this in my talk. To a certain extent, the Voting Rights Act right now is being held hostage to the circumstances of its implementation. When Lyndon Johnson signed the act, he said, "I think we've handed the South to the Republicans for a long time." And the South, which was a predominantly Democratic region for all of its existence, going back to Thomas Jefferson, had a long period of moderation, of electing moderate whites from roughly 1970 till about 1994. And then the bottom dropped out. And part of the reason the bottom dropped out was a creative implementation of the Voting Rights Act affected redistricting in such a way that it helped shove moderate Democrats out of Congress, and it shepherded in more Republicans while also creating more representative opportunities for African Americans and Hispanics. we are still living with the consequences of the 1994 election and the backlash among Southern white conservatives and Southern white moderates moving away from the Democratic Party. Polarized politics basically eradicated Southern white moderates, made them disappear. And it took the South off the playing field for the Democratic Party. So now for the Democrats to control the U.S. House of Representatives, they've got to win about 60% of seats outside the South, 60-62% of seats outside the South. That's a daunting challenge. Until you can shake up the U.S. House in particular, you're not going to get a good voting rights law.